Hey, Media People podcast listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, then you're going to love our newsletter, appropriately named the Media People Newsletter. Delivered right to your inbox, each edition is a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or go to mediapeople.behive.com. That's B-E-E-H-I-I-V. Thanks for listening to the Media People Podcast, lively and insightful chats with the people who power the media industry. I'm your host, Victor Genova. For more episodes, you can go to mediapeople.ca or subscribe wherever you get podcasts, including youtube.com/@mediapeoplepodcast. Views expressed by participants are personal. When Valerie Tyson interviewed for a marketing role with the Charlotte Hornets, it was team owner and NBA legend Michael Jordan who handled her final interview. And this is only one of the many stories comprising Valerie's sports marketing career. Valerie is the co-founder and head of strategy and sports at Unrivaled Group, a female-led, sports-driven tech consultancy. Valerie's career didn't start in sports, but local radio, running promotions for stations in Arizona and San Diego. She moved to KLSX in Los Angeles, where it provided her first taste in sports marketing. It included LA Kings radio broadcasts while simultaneously handling West Coast events for The Howard Stern Show. She jumped at the chance to lead marketing for the LA Avengers inaugural season in the Arena Football League, and it was from here her sports marketing career took off. Valerie Tyson stops by to chat about growing up in Chicago, why she studied journalism in university, creative ways to launch an arena football team, relaunching an NBA team in Charlotte after the original Hornets moved to New Orleans, and what she's out to accomplish with Unrivaled Group.
Unrivaled Group is a female-led software data-driven tech company, and we build intelligent brands, whether that be sports, entertainment, or in business. As the head of strategy, I'm responsible for creating our company's vision, strategically communicating our brand to internal and external stakeholders, executing business initiatives against those strategies, and sustaining all of our brand implementation efforts across sports and business.
Valerie, thank you so much for dropping by today. Let's go back to the beginning. You're a Chicago native.
I am born and raised in Homewood, Illinois, about 30 to 45 minutes south of the city, depending on the traffic.
And I know traffic is pretty bad in Chicago, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And as a kid in the suburbs, we took the train in a lot. So our parents would give us a little bit of money and send us into the city in high school on the train and just hope we came back. So.
Okay, so because you're from suburban Chicago, does that mean you get to pick between Cubs and White Sox? Because I think, well, if you're from the south side, it's White Sox, and if you're from the north end, it's the Cubs. Have I got it correct?
Well, it's funny because our CEO is also from the south side, and he loves the White Sox, and I was groomed a Cubs fan from birth. So my dad was a Cubs fan, used to listen to it on the back in the backyard cutting the lawn on the transistor radio, and so I've been a diehard Cubs fan since birth.
I'm not much of a baseball fan, but I got a chance to go to Wrigley Field and take in a Cubs game last summer, and it is quite the spectacle. There's something to be said about stadia that old, and no temptation from management at the Cubs to say, you know what, we're going to build something completely state-of-the-art that's got LED lights everywhere, half of it's glass, like kind of like a lot of the NFL stadia you're seeing now in Vegas and Los Angeles. Like, it really is a piece of art.
I mean, it's like retrofitting like a classic, because there's nothing, we also represent talent. So we have a former MLB catcher on our roster. And he said he knew one of the times he really made it when he played his first game in Boston as a Red Sox. And then, but taking in, it took his breath away at Wrigley Field. And so I think as a fan, it's the same thing going there. And it's the smells and the sound and the good Midwesterners. And you get to the seventh inning stretch. And it was Harry Carey back in the day. So it's hard not to be romantic about baseball when you go to a Cubs game.
Did you move around or did you pretty much stay in Chicago?
When I was a kid, through 18, I lived in Chicago. My mom and brother still live in the city. My dad has retired and left Illinois. But as soon as I graduated, I wanted to see the world. And so I went to the University of Kansas. So I lived in a couple places in Kansas. I got my second degree at Arizona State. So I lived in Tempe and around Arizona. And then I thought the holy grail of work would be living in California. So I probably lived in probably 25 to 30 cities my whole life, either moving with a job and primarily in sports. You know, you go where the next job is with the next team.
Have you lived in every time zone in the United States? Have you captured Alaska or Hawaii yet?
No, I have not. I got engaged in Hawaii. I have not been to Alaska, but I guess I got a couple more time zones to knock out. That's really good. I got to add that to my bucket list.
Okay, so growing up, you wanted to be a radio DJ. Where did that passion come from?
Dating myself, we had boom boxes, and there was this DJ on B96 in Chicago. His name was Johnny B, and he could just jibber jabber, and it was amazing. And he played the best songs, and it was like the era of the cassette when I was listening to him. And so I'd record it, and then I would like split it, and I would add my own intros to it. And so like late night in my room in the suburbs, like he'd play something, and then I would like cut in a Prince song or like my own intros and outros. And I think, I always thought, I knew I wanted to get my journalism degree. I thought I was going to be a writer, and the only internship available was radio. And so I had to like dig back in my Wayback Machine and remember splitting those tapes, because I did have to split a lot of tape in journalism school. I think I love storytelling, and I really liked the way that the DJs could bring this to life. And then I really got into NPR, how they could bring stories to life. And where I thought my whole life would be writing, it really started out in storytelling through radio. So I guess my boom boxes were for my parents. That was a good investment.
You're not dating yourself when you say that you had a boombox. I had one as well. Was it a double cassette deck as well too, so you could make your own mixtapes?
Of course. So not the first one. The first one was just gigantic and had the giant wheel to tune in the stations. But then I got like a sleeker one with that side by side on deck. So I could, like you said, drop in songs, edit in what I needed, record one to the other, record myself calling into the station to make requests. It was the whole thing. You could tell it was very exciting times in the south suburbs.
No, I had the same thing too. And let me guess, it was running on something like 8D batteries, and maybe you got 2 hours of music out of those batteries. And they
Oh,
cost a fortune back then.
so many batteries, and then you had to have like the coolest cassette. So if you're going to make a mixtape for someone, it had to be the clear cassette, like with the
Yes.
pink and the yellow label. So there was like very specific to like if you really cared about someone, they got a cool cassette as well.
Why do you set your parents as your role models?
Oh gosh, I think my parents, they set the standard for me, like to be a good person. Treat people well, treat people kindly, the golden rule, be a good neighbor, be a good friend, be a good sister. And I think them setting me up with like such a solid foundation allowed me to work and excel in extreme situations. I mean, I've been around a lot of athletes and celebrities and Hollywood and sports. And I think if I'd not been grounded by them and saw how hard they worked, I think they also, I definitely got my work ethic from them. I remember my dad going to work with holes in his suit so we could have things. And so I think watching how hard they worked, they set the expectation and the standard that I had to be the most prepared person in the room and outwork everyone. And I'm so grateful for that, because I think that's how I've been able to grow and have such an I mean, I'm so proud of, what I've done and my career path, and I couldn't have done that without them. That's what makes me the most proud, is I couldn't have done that without them.
Working in sports, you've had access to, or you've been close to, some of the biggest names like Michael Jordan and the late Kobe Bryant. What did you learn about work ethic just being, and I don't know how close you were to them, but just being able to see what they were doing firsthand?
It being in the ether of athletes like that, you learn that about relentless work ethic and wanting to be the best. Kobe was famously known for, and in real time, he did not tolerate laziness. I was in a Laker game. One of our interns threw a cup towards a trash can. It missed and fell out. Kobe, after winning, scoring the most points in the game, was on the court throwing free throws, and he saw the intern, and he said, "Not only are you going to pick up that cup, you're going to pick up all the cups around it that also people missed. Like, why would you want to be so lazy?" And so seeing that, and then seeing Michael, I mean, Michael owned a sports team when I met him, so he wasn't playing at the Bulls. He owned the Charlotte, he became full-time owner of the Charlotte Bobcats. And just seeing the best in the sport always push people and talk about wanting to be the best, it was like there wasn't another gear or another option. And so I think, coming and then like having my role in marketing on the front office of sports, I think the standard was set that everything I delivered had to be the best it possibly could, because it was for people who are setting the standard in their industries.
Did you see the Michael Jordan documentary on Netflix?
I couldn't have loved it more. It was amazing.
I thought it was crazy when both him and Phil Jackson were giving their perspective of the Bulls early on and how it was just customary back in the early 80s to say, hey, you know what? The first half's over. I'm going to spend halftime not drinking Gatorade and getting a lecture, but outside having a smoke. Like
It was.
you bring up that, but you bring up that point about discipline, and it's kind of funny seeing it through their eyes that they were very shocked at how undisciplined professional sports was when they were entering.
And well, I think a lot of that, and I think Kobe changed a lot of that. I mean, there's even stories with like the Team USA where everyone was out like touring the city, and Kobe had, when they left, he left the gym. When they came back home, he was going to the gym for his morning workout. So I think there are always moments of, you know, they're also like strong willed, so they're going to do what they want to do, but they didn't become elite by being lazy or like screwing around. It was really that discipline and mindset of over anything else was mindset. Like, I am going to be the best. I am going to dunk over you. I'm going to score the most points. We are going to win this many championships. And like, that's how everything in their life is. So when you're in a business meeting, they're like, well, what do you mean our YouTube video is number two? Like, why aren't we number one? So I think it's just the expectation of like, they set the tone in their careers, and that everyone kind of then in that work world was also to set the tone. Or at least that's, you know, that was my perception, that I always had to play up because they were at the top of their game.
How did Jeannie Buss impact your career early on?
It was very interesting. So Jeannie is now the president of the LA Lakers, and I was hired to work for Casey Wasserman, who's now the founder and I think CEO still of Wasserman Sports and Entertainment. I was Casey's fourth hire when he purchased an arena football team. And Staples Center was just being built, and the Lakers and the Clippers were, and the LA Kings were the anchor teams there. And we went to the kind of an all-team meeting to learn whatever was building safety, get to know each other, how the doors work, you know, all the things you have to learn when something's new. And I walked in, and Jeannie and I were the only women in the room, which I never really thought about. I just thought I had to be smart or unseen. For a long time, when I first got started, I was like, I was waiting for someone to figure out that I didn't know sports. And Jeannie looked around the table, and she saw me, and she says, can you put a chair next to me? She's going to sit next to me. And so it was really awesome to have the other, like, you know, like kind of the matriarch of, you know, what Staples Center and the Lakers were. She identified that maybe another woman might need a female role model. And so that was the first time I really became acutely aware that, oh gosh, we are the only ones in the room that are women. I still think I have to try to outwork everyone and be the most prepared person at the table. But it was really great seeing her do that. And it made me conscious about doing that for others moving forward.
Like many people have been on this podcast, your very first job ever was babysitting. What did you learn about yourself babysitting, and what did you learn about work and work ethic in general?
It was interesting. Like, all my friends had jobs, like they worked at like a drugstore or a store. And I knew I wouldn't be great into cash register. Like, math is not my sweet spot. But I was great with kids and my brother. And what I learned about babysitting is I could earn a lot more money if I came over prepared to that. So I would take a backpack, and I would have sheets if they had a wooden floor at home, so I could take kids on sheet rides around the house. I would have coloring books and pages, and I would bring movies. And the parents would pick me up, and they would always order dinner, and they would drive me home, and I would get a big tip afterwards. And I wasn't, of course, I don't think I was money driven, but I knew if I did a better job, they would hire me to do it again, and I'd have money to buy whatever I wanted or whatever it was I was into at the time. More cassette tapes, probably. But but it really taught, like, these people trusted me at 14 watching their two kids under five. Like, I probably shouldn't have been taking care of myself, but my parents saw that I really liked doing this. And the park district is a big thing in Chicago, and the suburbs had a big park district, and they had a 6-week babysitting training and emergency class. So my parents made me take that. So I made sure all the parents knew in our neighborhood that I was certified and I could do CPR and all kinds of things. And I just kept getting babysitting gigs from there. And it helped give me some, you know, extra cash in high school. And then it helped me get a job working with kids in the park district in the summers to help pay for college.
And from there, you were exposed to being rewarded for hard work, like not just a standard base pay, but an incentivized structure where if you put a bit more effort into it, you're going to get a bit more financially out of it.
My rate was, I don't know, maybe $5 or $10 an hour. I don't exactly remember, but I would leave after one night of babysitting with like $65 and a Christmas present, or like, they're like, oh, here's a, like, we want you this cute purse. Or they would like get me things because they were so appreciative of how happy their kids were. And then I would be booked like every weekend. I was like, oh, great. What can I bring next week? Like, no, we've got all the toys we need. But I always made sure I made that extra, like, went that extra mile. And it did pay off financially. But also, I really did it for, I guess, when I was younger, I wasn't as financially driven. I wanted them to like me and want to hire me again. And so getting rebooked right at that time, then going home with a pocket full of cash didn't hurt.
Instant gratification.
Right. And then I could go out and go to the roller rink or whatever I was doing back then. That was silly.
Why did you choose the University of Kansas, and why study journalism and political science?
In high school, I played soccer and I spent my lunches working on the school newspaper. And back in the day, it was like cutting out the strips and writing the articles, and I really liked it. And to be honest, in high school, I don't think like I was like a buoy. Like I kind of didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't kind of think I'd ever leave Illinois. And I wasn't like not motivated. I just didn't know really what I wanted to do. But I really loved working on this newspaper at lunch. And also like we didn't have a ton of money. So my school options are probably going to be limited to a state school. U of I was super hard to get into. So it's going to be one of the other state schools. But the only other school that was in my price range where I was able to go and also had journalism was University of Kansas. A ton of kids from my high school went there for the exact same reason. At the time, it was one of the top 10 journalism schools. And also when you're 18, you think, gosh, I just got to get out of state. I got to go anywhere. Like, I want to get as far away as I can and learn who I am and like hang out and have fun at college. And University of Kansas was a great place for that to happen. One of the coolest things that happened while I was there is I got to intern for Coach Roy Williams, you know, one of the greatest basketball coaches of our lifetime. It really escalated my love of the game and sports, and like started thinking about sports journalism. You know, I was still kind of floundering a little bit at Kansas. I didn't have like any campus jobs. I was studying. I wasn't great at math. I was kind of struggling in some of my classes there. But where I really got inspired were my journalism school classes and then interning for the basketball team, just seeing how like the business of sports worked. It wasn't just being around the, I mean, we were champions. Like we won national championship when I was there. But it was just being around one of like another elite coach, like an elite person at the top level, pushing people to be their best, whether you were an intern or you worked in the locker room or you're a player. Coach Williams always expected the best out of everyone. That really like stoked my fire.
How close did you get to the coach? Because you weren't on the basketball team, but you were working for the student newspaper. Did you have regular access to him?
At Kansas, I actually interned for the basketball program.
Okay.
Coach
okay.
Williams. So I was taking my journalism school classes, which I was like learning to love writing and kind of conflating a little bit, like, you know, sports journalism. But for Coach Williams, it was directly like it was checking up on the players if they were in class. It was going to practices and making sure they had all the information they needed for the travel days. I wasn't like in the locker room or anything. There weren't a lot of women or any in the locker room back in the day, but it was sort of the business function of the team. Like if they had an appearance, making sure they went, working on marketing materials, like the media guides. So I think that was kind of my real first exposure to what it was like to work sort of in the front office of sport. It was collegiate sports. So it was kind of what it was like to work in the front office of collegiate sports.
What motivated you, though, to continue your education at Arizona State?
There's two things. One, there was a really new, exciting program in the journalism space at the Walter Cronkite School. It had just been completely revamped. And two, I had terrible mono my last semester at the University of Kansas. And I was like, I was sick for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And I went on spring break to go visit a friend in Tempe, and I sneezed for 3 days and I felt totally well. And I toured the campus and I saw the journalism school and the editing bays were different. And there was all this access to TV stations because Kansas, you're a little separated from Kansas City and I didn't have a car. In Phoenix, everything is kind of in Tempe. It's kind of close together. There are a lot more access to do a lot of different types of journalism and media projects. And my parents didn't know, but on spring break, I paid the fee and filled out the application to see if I could transfer without their permission. And I got in and they were like, well, that's great. We think this is completely irresponsible. Like, this is what you want to do. We're not going to help you. So you're going to have to figure out how to make this work. And it was probably one, and it makes my parents sound terrible, but it was like the best thing I could have ever done for them, because from the day I set foot there, I had to like apply for jobs. So I only had a bike, so I couldn't take my car and I was paying for everything. And so I had to find jobs on campus that I could not only do between my classes, but like before school, after school, to get as many hours as possible. And my first job was in the vice president for research office. I walked in there and it was like answering phones, filing and writing grants, all stuff that wasn't what I wanted to do later on, but it prepared me. Like I have interns now who don't know how to answer a professional phone call or how to introduce themselves at an event. So going into these offices, and I worked in the president's office for events. I worked in the athletics department. I worked in the PR department. I worked in campus events. Like I learned how to organize information, organize events, introduce myself not only to my peers, but to researchers and guests to the university and greet guests for the president and introduce the president of the university to them. I learned how to file. Like, if nothing else, it's taught me how to have a really tight Google Drive now of all of our information. So I think some of those soft skills that I was really missing in terms of just like how you get along every day in an office or in a workplace, like I was so fortunate to live to do those on campus there in between my classes. And so I just walk from one building, go to my class, come back, answer some phones, file, write letters. So it was really great to have like kind of that soft skill opportunity. And then from there, they had a call for internships, and there were only two journal internships by the time I found out about it, two journalism internships available. And one was at a children's radio station, and the other one was the number one country radio station in the United States. And I wasn't a country music fan, and I picked the children's one because of my extensive babysitting background. And I got picked by the country music station, and that totally changed the course of my life. Working at the number one station in the country in Phoenix, Arizona, with an amazing team who loved each other, was nurturing. We were driving lots of revenue. I got to do a lot of on-air segments. I had to wear the Camel Country 108 suit at the Phoenix Zoo in July with 32 ice packs in it. I learned how to set up the kit so we could broadcast live. I learned how to work with our advertising partners. There's kind of two paths in that kind of marketing internship, and one was in sales and one was in marketing. I totally went down the marketing path. Like, I love promoting the station, putting together the book for Country Music Radio Station of the Year, and we won. It wasn't because of the book, it was because of the station. But to be involved again in people wanting to be the best and winning in their industry, it really, I really got into being and wanting to do more in radio.
You bring up an interesting point, and let me know if you agree with this, because I bring it up all the time when I lecture at universities and colleges. And I think the problem with post-secondary education is they're all about teaching the kids or the students to be the new leaders of tomorrow. The problem is that your first job out of college is unlikely to be a leadership role. And you can kind of see their faces kind of drop when I tell them that. And it's just because they're not prepared for that. And they believe they're prepared for it, but you've got people on the other side going, no, if you want to be a leader in this area, you need at least 10 years of experience. And they kind of resent the grunt work that comes with it, like being in the trenches. But you gravitated towards that. And it sounds like that really set a very good baseline for your future success.
I don't know that I had a hard, like, I want to do this. Like, I meet a lot of interns and young people who come into our organization, like, I want to be the CEO of a tennis club or whatever it is that they want to do. And it's interesting to what your point is. One thing I struggle with is I don't know how to teach effort. So I ask any young person coming to our organization as either an intern or a full-time employee, like, you may not love exactly what we're doing here, but here's what we do. And if you're interested in being a part of it, I promise to make you the most prepared person at the next table you sit. And I will open my Rolodex to anyone who's in my LinkedIn or my contacts to help you get where you want to go. But you don't go from this to the top. And I really think you're right. I think there is an expectation that not all, because everyone's different, everyone's individual, and they're all motivated and grew up differently. But there is a large group that come in and they're like, well, I thought I'd be making more deals and golfing with clients as an intern. And I was like, really? Because I don't golf with the clients. And they're like, well, I thought I'd be taking me. And I came out one day and this guy had his feet on his desk. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I was just kind of hoping that more clients would come in. And I was like, so there's a disconnect between, and it's also interesting too, because like we started from a startup perspective. After I did all the things I did in the industry and after I left IMG, I started, the first iteration of Unrivaled, and hiring people was just so interesting. Like in the interviews, they would ask me questions like, how many hot meals do I serve a day? And do I have kombucha on tap? Nothing about the workload.
What?
It was like about all the, it was so wild. Like I remember thinking, gosh, I don't know that I want to do this. And then there's some people who want to put their head down and really learn. And I will take them to every meeting and put them in front of every person at any level if there's someone who like really wants to work and learn. I think there's some people who want to get where they're going faster, which I understand and appreciate, but like there's also earned. You don't just title jump year to year. There's not an automatic raise every year. There's not a giant promotion every year. Like that's earned. And I think some of those things, when I see young people at school, they don't know that. And I hate to always be the bearer of bad news or like it's because you're small. It's not because we're small. Now we're like a 50 plus person organization. But it's different. It's earned. For me, it's like really earned and about integrity and how hard you are you know, how hard you're willing to work. And if someone doesn't know everything, but they are the best teammate and they try to outwork everyone in the room and they're trying to do a good job, like that person for me will like elevate faster than someone who, you know, maybe knows everything, but is a terrible teammate, is self-centered. One of my favorite Canadian philosophers, Ted Lasso, said to Jamie Tart, "You're so busy being number one, you forget that you're one of 11. And I think about that every day as a team. Like, we have to function as a good team, and that team is only as good as each individual working together. And so it's funny, to your point, I think about that all the time. It's hard to teach effort. Everyone wants to do like what I've done. Like, how did you get on private planes with all these athletes and famous people? And I was like, you must have been fun or had a lot of cocktails. And I was like, I had zero cocktails. I was not fun. They trusted me. I knew the job I had to do. I knew my role there. I knew when to speak. They took me along because they respected me and I was an important part of their team, not because I was like, hey, VT, you're a lot of fun. Come on. Like, they have friends for that. I wasn't their friend. I was, you know, someone who either worked for them or maybe considered a colleague, but it was because I was responsible. And that's really hard to teach people. But when you learn that early, there's no limit to where you can go.
Well, after Arizona, you ended up in San Diego. And this is an interesting segue because you end up at the largest country music radio station in the country. You go to San Diego and now you're working in classical radio. How did you find your way from country radio to classical radio in San Diego?
This is probably one of the life choices. It was good for my life as a young person. It's like where my ego came in, but probably not. I don't know if it was like my most strategic move. I met someone in Phoenix who had a house in San Diego, and I'd never been to California. I didn't even fly on an airplane until I was 19 years old. So seeing like going to California, the beach, everything I've seen on TV and all the TV shows, and I went to San Diego once to her house. I'm like, I'll do anything to live here. And I didn't think about the economics of it or if I could afford to live there. And my parents were like, are you sure that's a good idea? And there was a classical radio station looking for a promotion manager. And I had been in the promotion department at the station. I paid my own way to go out there. It was like my second plane trip ever. I got the job and I worked half-time answering the front desk phones and half-time as promotion manager. And I think I made $13,000 a year. I may be wrong, but it was like almost unlivable. I had an apartment, which I thought was huge. Later went back and saw it is not huge. I lived above two Olympic volleyball players. I thought that was amazing. And at the end of every week, I had to decide if I was going to take the $5 I had left to either buy rice or some kind of food or a beer at the local bar so I could try to make friends. Again, it was like another humble moment. Like, I did promotions and I did marketing. There were great salespeople there. And you know, there were a lot of people making, you know, great numbers and revenue and promoting the station. I was the only one in the area. We got to do a lot of cool things with the cultural scene in San Diego. But one of the coolest things that happened to me is that they had a trade relationship. And that means you trade advertising for a product. And in this case, we had a trade relationship with the San Diego Padres. And we had season tickets and no one at the classical station had any interest in baseball. They knew I didn't have any money and it was within walking, now it is, but it was within walking distance of a parking garage that went to the stadium at the time, which was Jack Murphy Stadium outside the downtown area. And I would use those tickets and people I had met, like friends I'd made, they're like, I'm like, hey, I've got these Padre tickets. They're like, great, I'll pay for parking and food. And I'm like, wait, I can't. And so I got to see an entire season of the San Diego Padres, 10 rows up from third base. And then the subsequent year, I got to see them go to the World Series. And I just love every game, every pitch, the theme songs. Like, that's when I really knew, like, I really think I could work in sports. Like, I love the storytelling. And, I think there's five things that bring people together. And one is, you know, birth and death. Two is music. Three is food. Four is cocktails. And five is sports. And just seeing people come together to root for their favorite team and the teammates pick each other up on the field and the beauty of a pitcher throwing to a catcher based on the calls. Like, that's when I really fell in love with sports. And I knew that, you know, I had to figure out somehow how I was going to transition the career, which I didn't know much later would come.
I like how you ranked cocktails above sports, bringing people together.
Yeah, I mean, I just think there's like those basic things like unite people, right? There's things that unite people and they aren't all, heartwarming things. But I think those five people, like those five basic buckets are pretty fundamental to galvanizing people.
We're going to take a quick break. Enjoying this episode? Of course you are, or you wouldn't have made it this far. Compliment your listening experience by subscribing to the Media People newsletter at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or at mediapeople.beehive.com. It's a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development.
On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or mediapeople.beehive.com. So how did you get out of San Diego and into Los Angeles at KLSX Radio?
Another not great life choice. I chased a boyfriend up to Northern California, and he's like, hey, I'm moving back to Los Angeles. And there was a promotion director job. It was KLSX FM talk radio. And I'm like, it's Los Angeles, the number two radio market. Like, I'm never going to get this job. And I applied and I got the job, and it was the home to Howard Stern. So we did a lot of Howard Stern's West Coast radio. We were one of the highest grossing radio stations. There was a promotion like every weekend. There was some other talk show hosts of varying degrees of like whatever their banter was. But we'd have events with like 10,000 people at the beach. And we had this little street team that had to manage and put up the banners and make sure the prizes were there and the clients were taken care of and the venue was set. And it was so fun. And I look back and everyone's like, gosh, you must have like partied a lot. And that was great. And I'm like, oh, I forgot to do all that. Like, I was so responsible and like thinking I had, I was in charge of these large events. I never thought about like, you know, throwing back a couple of beers while we were at this beach broadcast. I was so busy trying to make sure everyone else was taken care of. But it was amazing. And in doing that, our AM station, KRLA, they carried the LA Kings Los Angeles broadcast. And I became friends with someone who's now my mentor, Kurt Schwarzkopf, who's now with Ticketmaster. But he was the CMO of the LA Kings. And he said, hey, Valerie, there's this 27-year-old millionaire. He just got an arena football team. He's looking for a VP of marketing, and I recommended you. It turned out that was Casey Wasserman. And that was his probably fourth or fifth ever employee.
Okay, let's take a step back there. I'm a big Howard Stern fan, and I'm curious I love his stuff. And I'm curious to understand what it was like running West Coast events for Howard Stern and promotions, because this is at a point when he was still on terrestrial radio. He hadn't moved to Sirius XM yet. So, I mean, if anyone listening to this has seen the movie Private Parts, you'll know that there are a lot of times that he overstepped and you'd have listeners complain or the FCC. So what was that like? Was it easy to attract sponsors at that point? Was it easy to execute those events? Or was it kind of like, was it still very fairly difficult thing to do, given Howard's temperament and the type of content he covered?
I was there in the heyday. So I know financially we were getting the highest rates per 30-second, 60-second commercials. Like, we were sponsoring commercials by other sponsors. There was so much demand for it. And he would come out and do trips like he still does, you know, now it's serious, and do trips to L.A. He would come out and do, like, he did the Arsenio Hall show. He came out and did Magic Johnson's show. And then he would do his own shows. And there'd be wild things around it. So there's probably not a celebrity that I didn't have to open a door for going into the broadcast. It wasn't glamorous. It wasn't like I was back in the day, like if you'd taken a selfie with any of the people coming, you would have been fired immediately. So it was my job, like head down, here, introduce, here's where you sit. Howard would come out and meet them. And then when I met him, I expected it to be very wild because all the things I heard on the radio were wild. Like all the things that would happen in studio. And we had subsequent, after his show, wild and crazy shows all afternoon. You never know who'd show up in the office, what degree of clothing they were wearing or not wearing. Like what musicians would come through, what artists, what athletes. I mean, we were in LA, like Hollywood. So you never knew who would come in with a lot of this talk programming. But when actually meeting Howard in person, he was always the quietest person in the room when the mic was off. I was literally standing in front of the bathroom once and I was looking away, just manning my post. And I heard someone say softly, excuse me, and like clear their throat like they were bothering me. And it was Howard just trying to get into the restroom that I was blocking. And what people don't see, like they like to glom onto the part where you know all these women. And yes, I was in once I had to take some adult film stars to a Hot Planet Hollywood restaurant and I was on a date and they crawled on the table like cats. Like that stuff happened. And that's part of my job. And then Howard talked about it because one of the whack packs that I punched them in the face, I did not. I've never hit anyone. But what I took from Howard was beyond all that craziness and things where I probably could have gotten to myself in trouble if I was not a disciplined person, was that Howard was always the hardest working person in the room. So it wasn't like he just made up that stuff and it was crazy, wild, and wacky. Like, he put hours of time into that. Like, so as soon as he'd leave the studio, he would go home into his basement and he would create cartoons or any of the characters he would develop or who he wanted to interview. Like, he is probably still to this day, I'm assuming, a workaholic. And so the things, you know, that changed his personal life had no correlation to the show because He was a wonderful and loyal husband. He's been loyal to his employees. You can see I've worked there forever. He was so loyal and into and dedicated to his work that, you know, other things in his life changed. But he always was the hardest person in the room. He set the standard for everyone. He always knew what was happening. If someone screwed up or did something well, they were identified for either one of those. So I think being around his ether, seeing what a radio broadcast could amass. Like, we showed up, there'd be a few people in an event, and then it'd be like 1,000, and there'd be like 10,000 people. And this could be for any of the shows that even happened after Howard. We took over an entire Universal City Walk once with our broadcast. We filled like the entire like the mile section of the beach with one of our live broadcasts back in the day. So we were really at the peak of all that. It was unbelievable to see what the power of great marketing, great talent, and storytelling could really engage an audience. And I think I'm really lucky for learning that at an early point in my career.
Can we say that the LA Avengers Arena football team was your first full-time all-in foray into sports marketing?
100%. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life, where I met some of the people who are the most important and the best friend in my life today, and actually work with me here at Unrivaled now. And I was exposed to so many things in a million years I could never have imagined, and fully entrusted with these people that are now my friends, former colleagues and friends, to launch what was arguably one of the most successful arena football teams ever launched.
Can I just jump in there really quickly?
Yeah.
When did you learn about arena football? Because when you were there, the league, I did my due diligence, and Toronto had an arena football team for one season. They were the Phantoms, and they were relocated, I think, from New York to Toronto, and it didn't last year. But the league was still in its infancy. Did you have to do an extensive due diligence into arena football? Like, when someone said to you, hey, we've got this wonderful opportunity for you in arena football, did you have to stop and go say, wait, what? Not just football, arena football?
It was very different because I knew I loved sports, but how it was presented to me is, Valerie, there's a 27-year-old millionaire whose grandfather founded all of Universal Studios. They were going to give him an NFL team for his birthday, but they got him an arena football team in Los Angeles. He's looking for a vice president of marketing, and if you don't do this, you're an idiot.
That's a great pitch.
And it was my friend Kurt Schwarzkopf at the Kings. So he's CMO of the Kings, and he's like, this is not just arena football. And I didn't know it was going to be Casey Wasserman, Wasserman Entertainment. And I walked in there like the same person I am. I didn't change my personality in any way. And I think that's also another reason I stayed in the room. Like, I'm still a Midwesterner at heart. Like, I didn't go all Hollywood. Maybe I had more highlights in my hair, and maybe I got my nails done more often. But like, I wasn't like full diva or something. Like, I didn't get sucked into that whole attitude or like the LA lifestyle. I still who my parents grew me to be, hardworking. And I went to that meeting with Casey, and I had like, just like I show up to meetings now with too many PowerPoint slides. I made like 20 PowerPoint slides. I mean, here's what the name of the team should be, and here's how we'll market it, and here's your media plan. And he looked at every slide and he said, well, we're not doing any of those things. We already have some of these plans. He's like, but no one put as much effort into this. Hopefully we'll talk again soon. And 2 days later, I was offered a job that changed my life and set my career on a completely different trajectory.
What did you learn about yourself, or what did you learn professionally from working on the LA Avengers arena football team? Because right now, even though you're in, what is LA, the second biggest media market in the United States? The second biggest media market, but you're still... this is still a relatively unknown sport. Like, you really have to launch this brand. It's not like the Kings that have been around since, I think, the late 60s or early 70s, or like you mentioned, the Lakers and the Clippers and all of the baseball teams. This is something net new. It's not just a new brand. It is a new type of sport, and it's a spin on a very, very, very American sport.
It's so funny, like, when I hadn't done it before and no one else had done it before in Los Angeles, and I was never afraid. Like, I was never, fear came a little bit later. I'm sure we'll get to that. But he was 27. I was 28. Like, we're all around the same age. There's a lot of USC and UCLA grads who maybe worked in an athletic department. And to Casey's, like, I mean, he picked some really great people, and he was like, okay, you're never sold sponsorships. You're going to work with our sponsorship team that, you know, and looked at the woman, you sell sponsorships. Valerie, you got to sell out all the tickets and do all the branding and work with our brand team. One of my best friends, John and Antoine, who works with me now, you guys are in charge of PR and tickets. And we're like, okay, like, none of us had ever done that before. And, just because it was Casey didn't mean we had infinite budgets. We had limited budgets. And it was in a city that didn't care for football, that had lost several football teams, traditional teams. So how the heck were we going to get them to come to an arena football game? And we leaned into like family fun entertainment, the most affordable way to come into, because it was the first summer Staples Center was open, arguably the best arena in the world at the time. And how do we package that in a way with like family fun packs and family meals? How do we make it affordable? Because I remember going to meetings. Our offices were not inside the building. I'd go to meetings at the building and there'd be people who took the bus to try to buy two Lakers tickets. They'd bring their kid outside. And they couldn't. The tickets were sold out. They were not affordable. And Casey always made sure we carried tickets to give to people that we'd see outside Staples Center so they could come back and at least see an arena football game, where we lost no less than 13 footballs into the stadium. Like smash mouth football, loud music. Because of Casey's relationship with Universal Studios, we showed new movie trailers. We had the best, arguably like the top dance team in LA. And I know that's saying a lot against the Laker girls, but we took a lot of hints from the best parts of LA and packed that in 8 nights a year. And it was, you know, and we made sure to try to program those games either weekday nights or after, like not competing with the beach times. Everyone wants to be at the beach in California. It's so beautiful there. So really being strategic about that. And then really being strategic about our marketing campaign. We did a tease and reveal campaign where you probably couldn't run this campaign today, but it was, you know, like a teaser campaign on Sunday, April 9th, which was our home night. And it would be some nuance of football. Hundreds of men will leave their wives for other men. And then 2 weeks later, it was like, come with your best friend to see our games. So there's a lot more. That's like one of the tamer ones. And we teased those and we put them up on, and it was because advertising is also expensive. We didn't have a big budget. We put this campaign up and we had 300 billboards around Los Angeles, which is really nothing in a city of that size. And they were all small, not freeway. It wasn't one board on a freeway. And I walk into work and my friend John, who's our PR guy, is pale. And he said, Valerie, the lobby is full of reporters from around the world. They wanted, and we didn't say LA Arena Football. So they had to figure out who we were. And he's like, they want to meet the man that came up with this campaign. And I was like, you the man? Like, and he's like, no, you created this. And we actually had to go on the Today Show and talk about the truth in advertising, because the mayor of the city of Pasadena used city time and city employees to paint over our billboard because he thought it wasn't good for his community. We had a bunch of different slogans of varying degree of taste, I guess, now looking back at it, but we sold out all 8 nights and we lost the majority of those games, and people renewed for the second year because we delivered on our promise of delivering the best indoor entertainment in Los Angeles. We sold more beer than the Lakers on most nights.
That is fantastic that you got the mayor of Pasadena in a bunch and he got city employees to paint over your advertisements. Mm-hmm.
And we had to go on the Today Show, so I had to like wire in from Los Angeles, and I went with our PR person, and I put the headphones on. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm 27. Someone's going to figure out I don't know anything about sports. And they were in my headphones, like, hey, Valerie, this is Joey. Tell Casey we said hi. You're going to do great today. And I can't remember who it was, like Brian Williams or someone, but it was like a really prolific. It was live. It was on a Saturday. My Midwestern parents, of course, were like, I can't believe you came up with this campaign. And I don't know if they were embarrassed or proud. I didn't really ask. It was probably good enough to know. And to go on into debate truth in advertising. And, you know, he's like, what the young Miss Valerie doesn't know. And I got this look and I heard in the headphones, like, oh, no, we've seen that look before. And so we took that guy to town because we all of our boards were cleared. He shouldn't have done that. And it stirred up a city, like a city that's like, you know, the people go to Dodger games in the third inning and leave in the seventh and leaving games early or not going or empty seats. Like, we didn't have that. Like, we had to do something to really disrupt the market. And we owned every piece of that. One of our campaigns was very funny. So after the billboards, my voicemail was always full, like people who loved it, people who hated it, like threats. And one of our print ads to match those billboards said, if you're going to buy front row tickets, make sure you have this. And there's a picture of an organ donor card.
Oh,
and I walked into the office and they like, Valerie, the president of the LA Organ Donors Association, is on the phone. And I'm like, of course he is. Is my voicemail full? They're like, your voicemail's full. And so I picked up the phone. And I was like, hi, I'm sure you saw our ad. He goes, I just want to know. He's like, the organ donor business is not always hopping. People are not keen to give up their organs. Can we put organ donor cards on the front row of all your seats for the rest of the games? I was like, abso-freaking-lutely. Like,
oh, that is awesome. What better compliment could you have had? than that.
I mean, because you never know, people would call and I hate you, and this billboard is close to my school, or this was raunchy, or whatever. And I learned a lot about like trying not to internalize some of that stuff, because it made the news, it made global news. Like every day there was a story about our campaigns. But like, and then when we got there, like all of our, like the organ donor, and it was all of us kids like out there. We didn't know. We put the organ donor cards out. We set up the dasher boards. We were there when it flipped from ice to sod. We made sure all the suites, there's like 10 of us who had to do all these things because it was a startup. And arena football has, you know, had varying levels of success and growth over the years. And so there was like 10 of us, and you know, the crew from Staples Center obviously does the heavy lifting and manages the building, but like we were in charge of the activations and making sure sponsorship deals were fulfilled and that all the right words ran on the LED screens, and were the sacks there for the halftime sack race, and was the post-game concert like stage able to roll out over the field, like, and I don't even know why someone entrusted us with this. It was really great. Like looking back, I'm like, gosh, like, I can't believe that. It was a bunch of really good people, I guess, was the core of it. Looking at that age, having never done that before, it was just really remarkable.
Valerie, you've done a number of things in sports marketing. We could go on for a couple of hours about that. But one other role I want to pick out is the Charlotte Hornets. Because even though they are the Charlotte Hornets, if we go back to the origin of your role there, it's tied to the origin of this team, right? We should say it's Second Life, because this was the Charlotte Bobcats, technically. So to set it up for everyone, Hornets expansion team in 88, they play through the 90s. And then what year did they leave for New Orleans? Was it 98 or 99?
I think it was 99.
And then Charlotte doesn't have a basketball team. And then they're granted an expansion team. But because the Hornets name is still being used in New Orleans, they have to come up with a new brand. And then this is where you enter with the Charlotte Bobcats. So take us through what that was like, reintroducing a team to Charlotte, still knowing that the old team is out there playing on the old brand in a different city.
It was interesting. So it was my first like big sports job. And the chief marketing officer of the team had been my agency for the Avengers. So we had worked a lot together on brand. He had really groomed me well for the sports industry. He still to this day is one of the top leading brand experts. And so he called me one day, and I always knew I wanted to work for him. He was just someone, a force. Like, I was his client, you know, as our agency, but I knew I wanted to work for him. And one day out of the blue, he called and said, "How do you like to come work for Michael Jordan?" And I was just newly married. I had just closed down a house. And as soon as we took the for sale sign, or sold sign out, we put it right back out for sale. And growing up in Chicago, my husband, he's a software engineer, so he doesn't get to do these exciting things. He's like, "Heck yeah, like, let's go to Charlotte." And I remember when I met Michael, he was my last interview of my day there. And I saw him coming towards me. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm going to meet Michael Jordan." And he said, "Valerie, we both have something in common. I heard we have something in common." And what I should have said in that moment of awe was, "We're both from Chicago." But instead I said, "We both scored more than 38,000 points in the NBA. And he looked at me and said, "No, we're both from Chicago. Welcome to the team." So that wasn't my smoothest move, but it was interesting because there's, you know, I was new to Charlotte. And so it was like I had to like gauge, you know, and there were some great people who were holdovers from the Hornets, some who work for us now at Unrivaled, because I think I met some of my best teammates through my previous jobs. And there was a love-hate relationship. Also, that form of the Bobcats was refinanced in New York when Charlotte was the banking capital at the time. So now you're trying to sell sponsors like to Wachovia and other banking institutions at the time, but you finance your bank out of the city. So how are you going to get those sponsors to come on board? So it was very interesting. It was interesting how the arena, you know, there's always like city contribution and things to arena building. Some people didn't like that. It was trying to find and build a brand that people could get behind. And there was my job, I was responsible for working with the design team and the agencies to help redefine what that logo would be. And then it was like top to bottom, stripping the entire arena of the old brand. It's ironic now that I like to focus on women's sports now, because there was 3 months where I walked around with a paint can and a scraper, like identifying things from the Charlotte Sting, the women's team that no longer was a part of the organization. Like removing the women's team was like a part of my job, which is now like soul crushing to think about it a little bit. But it was very interesting. People loved or hated it. I think the heart of it is they wanted a team that they could get behind and love. And it was definitely, I think, rocky in the beginning, and we didn't have the best team. We would promote, "Hey, come see LeBron," and, you know, "Come see like whoever, whatever player." And then, you know, the first year I was there, it was, you know, very rough. And then going into the second season, it was like, we need to get down to brass tacks. And working with our CMO, we can't promise that we're going to win a championship. We can't promise that we're going to win tonight's game, but we can promise to be better. And our theme became Elevate because of the motion of basketball and also working and benchmarking against yourself to get better. We had the Charlotte Orchestra cut like this rockin' version of U2's Elevate. And our home game, the court was dark and people could hear the orchestra, but you never saw them or heard them go onto the court. When the lights came up, they were like ripping off their shirts and had their ties on and like, going crazy playing Elevate. And all we could do was benchmark against ourselves and earn trust. And that's how we drove revenue and business performance and brand love by being more honest. It was very hard. It was almost harder than arena football because you were starting from zero. You were building a brand. This was, like you said, a complete market switch. Brand loyalty, the team still existed somewhere else. And it was a lot of years of working through that. Everything from reorganizing databases. When I got there, they were sending every email to a million people. There was no segmentation. Someone who bought a courtside seat would get an offer for a $5 upper bowl seat. So really digging in and kind of doing the business due diligence to reorganize marketing and how we approached our fans. What kind of VIP treatment to get repeat people get? And then how did we get the word out to try to get other people to come in? How do we attract groups? And so we had to work harder than most teams, but we went from the basement of NBA metrics that second year to the top five teams in our marketing improvement performance. And then the Hornets, after I left there, I was always there during the Bobcat era. And then having Michael Jordan there was always like a fun, it was a different outlier because people like everyone wanted to run into him at, you know, in events, and we had to organize what we called bumps. We didn't tell Michael that he was going to run into this person that we had to have him meet, which accidentally in the hallway at a game. He caught on to that pretty quickly, but it was like really working hard on that business performance. And it was kind of like, you know, what I learned at the Avengers is like, we have to be the best version of ourselves and honest with what we're going to deliver. And if we do that, it's going to be hard not to love us. And I think that's really how we built that brand trust back. And then when the Hornets came back, obviously that was only further amplified.
So you weren't with the team when they reverted back to the Hornets after?
I was not.
Being a spectator, I guess, at that point, or an alumnus, how did you feel knowing that, oh, okay, now they're just reverting back to the Hornets because it's, the name and the brand has become available and all the equity we've tried to build up with the Bobcats is just evaporated?
I don't know. I think there's kind of two things. There's like the game performance, you know, the team, everyone wants to win. Like everyone wants to win the last game of the season, right? So I think, you know, in the championship and get the hardware and all that good stuff. I think the Hornets coming back was another ray of hope for the like Charlottesians that wanted to have a winning franchise there. And so I'm not mad about it. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, every pole in the building, every banner, the sign on the top of the building. I mean, when you do a rebrand of a team, it's not only incredibly financially expensive, but it's like exhaustive in terms of their logos, places you never even thought there were logos. And so when I thought about it, I was like, oh God, all those hours we spent, you know, flipping the arena. But it's really not about that. It's like what's best for the city and what's best for the fans. And then really what's best for business performance. So it's like, what are we going to do? I mean, also it's the business of sports. You want everyone to love you and to be beloved and sell out your tickets, but it's a business. There's a business and a science and art to selling tickets, to selling merchandise, to selling sponsorships. And so bringing the Hornets back was the best for the business of Charlotte basketball.
Okay, so let's bring everything full circle. And I just want to say there are a number of different roles you had at IMG and a couple of other companies that we could talk about, but I know time is tight. You're a very busy person, and thank you for being generous with the time that you do have today. So let's bring everything full circle. Unrivaled Group, where did the idea come from?
I met and married a Texan, and I took him away many times, as you can tell through our time here together today. And I was at IMG. And what I learned there working with, again, some of the top athletes and brands at another level, it was just like every level was like another level up, is that I thought on a smaller scale, I could build my own version and just be really hands-on and very boutique in terms of sports and entertainment. And that's what we did for 5 years. We started as Strategic Playground during the pandemic. We rebranded as Unrivaled Group because who doesn't want to be unrivaled? And then we added a talent division. So we also represent athletes. But what we really enjoy, or what I'm passionate about, is athletes when they peak out of sports. So athletes in sports and what they're going to do next. and connecting them to whatever it is. It's not if sports ends, it's when. So that rebrand was amazing. It was just so funny how like you can just do a change in a name and a logo and the entire perception is different. At the time, I think we were one of 5 or 6 female led and run sports agencies. And so that was great. Pandemic hit, everything shuts down. You know, so it was time to really dig in and think about who we were. And then we had a great, strong agency business. I get to work with a lot of people from my career. And about 6 months ago, I met the engineer responsible for creating Windows 95. And he sits on a bunch of the Gates boards and a lot of tech boards and has built some of the world's greatest technology. And he found me. He goes, hey, we're both from the same part of Chicago. How did you get to where you were in your career? And he said, well, what if you could change the world of business and sports for women? You could change the game. And so now we have, in addition to being, we have our consulting services. We are a software-based company. We will, by the time we'll be launched by the time this podcast airs, but we have the only piece of software where we can connect women-owned certified businesses to corporations with contracts that has to greater contracts than women-owned businesses have ever been exposed to. Women now only represent 1% of the business supply chain. And so providing those opportunities through our software, our proprietary software built by an OG from Microsoft, we can actually change the game for women in business. It's hard for women to get investments. Capital for women is harder to get. We can actually change the path for women in business and women in sports. And we do that through data. So on the sports side, so we still do what we do in sports. We can build ecosystems with very specific data. A lot of our clients didn't own their own data and we weren't a software company. So we were taking third-party data, trying to make marketing and strategic decisions for them. And they were closely accurate. But what if you actually owned your own data sets and you could actually build predictable models for your revenue instead of guessing and coming up 10 to 15% short every year? So now we do that on the brand and property side. And then for women-owned businesses, we build ecosystems where women control their own data and have exposure to greater opportunities or earning more revenue than women-owned businesses previously have done. And now due to COVID, the government actually has corporate incentives. There's a minimum that corporations have to spend with women and minority-owned businesses, and it has to be digitally proven. And we only have the only piece of software that does that now. So getting to connect corporations to great women-owned businesses and sports and beyond is something I never dreamed of for Unrivaled, but it's really exciting evolution.
Is there a particular women's sports league that you guys do the most business with? Just for perspective, up here in Canada, the Professional Women's Hockey League is on fire right now. It's doing absolute gangbusters. And I know that the National Women's Soccer League is doing equally as well in the United States. And then I actually want to throw a third thing in there as well, the NCAA name and likeness. Like, are you working with those independent athletes as well too?
We do a lot of strategic planning with a lot of leagues, some of which are female. And I think that what's really interesting too is that we were really heavy, until like the last year or so, really on the brand side. So doing strategic planning with brands and how they should engage with leagues or which leagues were the best, where they should place their dollar sponsorship to gain conversions, and followers of their business. Because that's why brands partner, right? It's a business. And I can't say better things about what's happening in both women's hockey, soccer, and basketball right now. Everyone talks about it's a moment. I hope it's not a movement. We look at it, we have Unrivaled Women as one of our brands, and it's a movement. Someday I hope that people talk about they're watching the basketball game and they don't have to say that they're watching the women's game because it's just basketball. And the fact that female athletes have been undervalued and underpaid, we have to bridge that pay gap. And, us reinventing here recently, it really allows us to help democratize that pay gap. And, it's not an era. I'm hoping this is a trend that continues, that we see the growth of women's sports. And like people fight it, like, oh, it's women's basketball or it's women's hockey. Like, go watch it. Go watch the crowd. Like, it is, the sports are incredible. The fandom is off the charts. And, anyone who's a fan of sports, you don't leave feeling any different because you saw a men or women's game. You want to see people compete and play at the best level possible. And I'm here for it. I'm in the front row eating popcorn, watching women's sports now because It's really amazing, and I can't wait. And this is one of the, I think it's the biggest year. Now is the largest sponsored year of NCAA women's basketball. So, a couple of years ago, we were talking about, they had two hand weights in the locker room, and the other, the men's had, full gym. But that's not the case anymore. So I'm glad that we are trending in the right direction. There's a lot of work to go. I think the problem that we still need to solve in women's sports is, women's sports aren't shown during prime time because the brands aren't spending and investing enough in women's sports to have them shown there. And then when you don't have that investment, women have less tools, less NIL endorsements, and it's just cyclical. So we need the brands to stand up so the networks will stand up and show that, so there's more exposure to people who can't make it out to games, to girls sitting at home who don't have exposure to those women's games. So until we solve that problem, which we're working on through some of our ecosystem work now, until that problem is solved, there's always going to be a disparity. But I'm hoping, at least our firm now is really working to try to be on the forefront of closing that gap.
I'm a massive racing fan. I'm like the only Canadian in Toronto that can't name three players on the Toronto Maple Leafs. So I've always been it's true. I've always been exposed to female athletes because racing has been a gender neutral sport. Do you guys do any work in motorsports, in NASCAR or IndyCar by any chance?
We have done a bunch of work in NASCAR for brands activating in NASCAR. And a good friend of mine and mentor, Cindy Sisson, she started a women's motorsports organization, really galvanizing all the women across F1, NASCAR, all kinds of racing. And I think that's really like having a moment now too. And again, that's only building. Some of the top engineers for some of those F1 teams, they're run by women. They run the data, they run the technology stack. It's great to see more people like me in those industries.
Valerie, so what's next for Unrivaled Group?
Next week, we are launching our first ecosystem. So we will be launching at the WeBank Conference in Denver, which is one of the most powerful women's organizations in the country. And we will be meeting women-owned businesses and connecting them to corporations for greater wealth opportunities and hopefully changing the game for women in business.
We're recording this late March, and this is going to go live April 9th. So anyone listening to this right now, is it safe to say what you just spoke about is already going to be in market? They don't have to wait another week or two for it.
Correct. All you have to do is visit unrivaledwomen.com or unrivaledgroup.com.
Valerie, this has been a fantastic chat. Are you ready for rapid fire questions?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Okay. The campaign you are most proud of?
The Los Angeles Avengers on Sunday, April 9th campaign. Hands down, one of the best things I've ever been a part of.
Your favorite movie?
Tie, Moneyball and The Intern.
If Hollywood were to make a movie based on your life story, who would you want to play you?
The cast from Ted Lasso, particularly Juno Temple and Rebecca Waddingham. I think they're badass women in Hollywood, and the way they depicted their roles in and around the front office of sports was amazing.
There is nothing wrong with that show, and I know they talk about a potential season 4. I don't want it. I just want it left alone the way it is.
I have a Ted Lasso tattoo. It was the first tattoo I ever got. I was so motivated by that show. Onward, forward. You have to always move ahead and benchmark and get better, and it's on my inside of my left arm. Onward, forward, from the great Canadian philosopher Ted Lasso.
My follow-up question: if Hollywood were to make that movie based on your life story, what would you call it?
How Lucky Am I?
Your favorite book?
To Kill a Mockingbird, 100%.
Your favorite song?
I always debate because it could be a walk-up song or not, but I am a huge Hamilton fan, so Wait for It from Hamilton and probably The Champ by Nelly.
The best advice you've ever received?
Build a personal board of directors early on in your career that will be a mirror for you and hold you accountable and be your biggest cheering section.
My signature closing question: if you weren't in media and marketing, what would you be doing and why?
I would be a comedy writer for SNL. I would be best friends with Tina Fey, and I would be in the writer's room creating things that made me laugh all day.
Valerie, this has been a fantastic chat. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.